Thomas Webb versus Commonwealth, Mr. Hamrick and Ms. Darren.
Good morning, Your Honor.
And I'll also mention for people that might have come in, a couple things, people might have come in late, please be aware of our dangling microphone cord over there. I apologize, we don't seem to have equipment that meshes with state-of-the-art equipment, so we have to improvise. And secondly, we do not have a timing light in this courtroom. I will keep time from the bench. I will let you know when you're into your rebuttal. You may reserve or continue to argue as you wish, but you will only have the 15 minutes total regardless. So with that having been said, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, please.
How much?
5 minutes.
All right, 5 minutes. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Hamrick. I represent Elliot Thomas Webb. I also represented Mr. Webb at the trial in the Pulaski County Circuit Court. On July the 22nd, Mr. Webb pled not guilty and was tried by a jury on one count of distribution of a Schedule II drug, namely cocaine, after priors. After the trial was concluded, the jury found by unanimous verdict that Mr. Webb was guilty of the charge. The jury heard additional evidence and testimony regarding sentencing. Mr. Webb testified on his own behalf at the sentencing hearing. The Commonwealth also introduced Mr. Webb's prior criminal history.
Am I correct that the Commonwealth attorney did not make any attempt to correct the record at the trial court as to whether or not the sentencing verdict was unanimous?
Yes, sir, you are
so
correct.
So we have what we have, which is a transcript showing effectively a non-unanimous verdict.
Yes, sir.
But it looks like the only issue then is whether the failure of the defendant to raise that issue precludes our review on appeal. Could you maybe move to that?
I sure can. Yes, sir. Your Honor, and we concede that the defense did not object to the non-unanimous verdict at the hearing. Henry Hudson was the second juror, as referenced on the joint appendix, page 221, the second juror to answer the clerk of court's question upon the defense's poll. There were essentially 10 jurors afterwards that answered the question yes, and the juror before Juror Hudson answered the question yes as well. Juror Hudson answered no. At the time, the defense did not object. We are asking that this be considered under the ends of justice exception 5A:18. Your Honor, we would submit to the court that the record is clear, that the record was not objected to, no exceptions were made to the record pursuant to the Virginia Supreme Court Rule 5A:8D.
Well, how does this error rank in terms of the type of error that evidences a manifest injustice?
Your Honor, we would say that the evidence ranks as a manifest injustice because the jury specifically cited that their verdict was unanimous when the foreperson indicated that they had reached a verdict, that the judge essentially relied on that verdict at formal sentencing, specifically stating in his sentencing at the sentencing hearing that he sees no reason to change the verdict of the 12 people. Your Honor, the...
It looks like nobody caught this. Either one of two things happened. Either that the stenographer, it wasn't even the stenographer, that the person who typed up the transcript from the tape recording got it wrong, or nobody in the courtroom actually heard what this person said.
And Your Honor, we would concede that no one in the courtroom heard what it said. As soon as counsel read the transcript, I immediately contacted the state bar and asked what my obligation was to independently investigate. They told me that I absolutely had the obligation to independently investigate this transcript. I contacted first the court reporter who prepared the transcript, who was not the same court reporter who said.
Let's get back to the
yes,
law
sir.
That we're talking about.
Yes, sir.
Unanimous verdicts are not required by the U.S. Constitution, are they?
Unanimous sentencing verdicts are not required by the U.S. Constitution. Unanimous verdicts are required by the Virginia Constitution. The sentencing aspect is statutory. In the statutory scheme, we would submit to the court that the application of the ends of justice, that what it says, and I'm citing Akers v. Commonwealth, which is a Montgomery County case as well, that says basically that the ends of justice, that the proof of an error has to be clear, substantial, and material. We would certainly...
Go back to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. The defendant is entitled to an impartial jury of his vincage, without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty. Does that apply to a sentencing verdict? Must that be unanimous?
It's unclear, and we would submit to the court that it does. We would submit to the court that the client is entitled to a jury trial, that he is entitled to the jury having their unanimous consent to find him guilty, as well as on the sentencing aspect. We have specific statutory schemes in Virginia, namely the 19.2257, which allows a judge to sentence outside of a jury trial. Also, we deal with 19.2-295, which basically indicates that the both parties can agree, if the jury is not unanimous, to have the court sentence at that point in time. So while we have certain statutory schemes set up to ensure that there is a unanimous verdict as to sentencing, I'd point the court to the case of Carver v. Commonwealth, which we cited in our brief. Now, understanding that Carver v. Commonwealth was in the guilt or innocence phase of the trial. In that case, a juror indicated that she did not agree with the verdict, that she did not feel the defendant was guilty. However, the juror in that case indicated that she went along with the verdict because they, referencing the other members of the jury, indicated that he or the defendant would only be fined in that situation. Upon further questioning, and we concede that the judge was able to question that juror in that respect, that was not the case in our case here. Upon further questioning, the court accepted the verdict. That was overturned on appeal. The case was sent back. Your Honor, we would submit to the court that certainly this raises to the issue of a manifest injustice, that we have proven that manifest injustice by the transcript which was submitted to the court, which was not objected to by counsel. It was submitted to the trial court pursuant to 5A:8D, I apologize. And Your Honor, we would submit to the court that we have proven a manifest injustice, and we would ask the court to remand the case for a new sentencing hearing. I understand that we did ask in our brief for a new trial. However, we do recognize what the proper remedy here is, and that's a new sentencing hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. You have approximately 8 minutes remaining in your time, should you choose to use it. Ms. Darren?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Sitting in here in the courtroom this morning, there seems to be a common theme running through many of the court's cases this morning, and that is the application of waiver. And the rule that we're talking about in this case, Rule 5A18, as another attorney said this morning, which I thought was very appropriate, he said when he's training his public defenders, he tells them, before you can complain on appeal that the judge got it wrong, you've got to give the trial court the first opportunity to get it right.
Well, can we concede in this case that we are stuck with this transcript that shows a non-unanimous sentencing verdict?
We are stuck with the transcript. That's right.
And
but
doesn't that make the sentencing verdict then void? It does not comply with the statute or with Rule 3A17?
No, Your Honor. We would submit that the record is inadequate for this court to make the leap to that determination. And we would submit...
Well, I thought you just said we do have a non-unanimous sentencing verdict.
We have a transcript which indicates a non-unanimous
sentencing verdict. Record that we must rely on? Can we go behind that in any way?
No.
Okay.
And so what
I'm... We are considering a non-unanimous verdict.
We have a transcript which indicates a non-unanimous sentencing verdict.
And the Constitution of Virginia requires unanimity of a jury verdict.
Well, we submit that the Constitution applies to the guilt phase of the trial. This was the sentencing phase of the trial. But even if the court were correct on that point, there are many, many issues, constitutional issues, that can be waived by failure to object.
Well, you mentioned in a footnote the concern that I have, and I agree with you that errors can be waived, but not if they're structural errors. And it seems to me that although it's never been addressed whether a non-unanimous verdict is a structural error, at least anything I can find, that it is a defect affecting the framework from within which the trial proceeds rather than simply an error in the trial process itself?
Your Honor, we would agree with the court if the issue had been raised in the trial court and the trial court had been given the opportunity to question the juror as the rule calls for, and to make a determination whether, in fact, the juror's verdict was not unanimous. If the court had had that opportunity and had gone ahead as it did in in the case that other counsel cited this morning, in the face of the juror saying no, then certainly we would have a non-unanimous verdict that this court could say was structural error and reversible error. But we don't have that second half. And what we do have in this case, Your Honor, is a situation where the record reflects that this juror was, first of all, if you look at what the clerk says at the sentencing phase, all the clerk does was she just calls the jurors' names. She doesn't ask them, as she did at the guilt phase, to say yes if this is your verdict. So all she does is starts calling the jurors' names at page.
You seem to be backpedaling a little bit as to whether this is in fact a unanimous or non-unanimous sentence, and that to me is a pretty fundamental starting point of the analysis.
Well, I may have misspoken, and I apologize for that. What I am saying is that we have a transcript which indicates a negative answer, and that is all I am conceding at this point.
Does the court have the power to enter a non-unanimous verdict?
It does not. By statute.
Are you then arguing that this is not a verdict?
I'm arguing that.
Are you arguing that the sentencing disposition is not a verdict?
I'm arguing that the record before you is inadequate for this court.
Well, let's assume that we believe the record is adequate, that we take no as no, which is what it says.
The court,
if we accept the record as establishing a non-unanimous verdict, albeit a sentencing verdict, does the court have the power to enter that verdict?
No. However,
that would be a denial of a significant right.
Yes.
And that would be a manifest injustice.
But we don't have that here.
But would that be a manifest injustice? Would that constitute a manifest injustice for 5-8?
If we had that set of facts in this case. But what we have here.
I don't understand your argument about the record, so you better help me a little bit.
Well, this is a classic case of where someone might. I'll be honest,
they might
I can't.
Have said no and they might have said yes?
Yes, exactly. You have to look at the context.
Doesn't
first of all.
Take a lot of speculation on our part.
No. I think you, first of all, you have the jury foreman saying that the sentence is unanimous. And then we have everybody in the courtroom indicating that the jury, everything that happened in this case until the transcript comes in indicating this negative answer.
But at that point, isn't it the obligation of the Commonwealth attorney to go to the court and ask that the transcript be corrected, that there's an error in the transcript?
Yes.
And without doing that, isn't that a waiver? So we're back.
No.
The starting place. This is what we have for the record.
Well, no, I would say that it's not the Commonwealth's attorney's obligation. First of all, polling of the jury is not required. It was something that defense counsel asked for.
Isn't so, the statute that requires the court to poll the jury?
If it's asked for.
Okay.
If it's asked for. So he asked for it, and then first of all, What does the record before you show? The record before you shows that we have the jury foreman, we have the jury coming back, we have the jury foreman coming in and saying, in response to the court's question, yes, our verdict is unanimous. The court asks Mr. Defense Counsel, would you like the jury polled? He says yes. And then we have the jurors being called by name. This particular juror, and I think this is a significant point, he's second in line here. So We don't know whether he misunderstood the question or whether the fact of the matter is that nobody sitting in that courtroom said anything or made any indication that there was an irregularity in the proceeding,
it's a stunning oversight if that's what it is, but in this case, if I recall correctly, wasn't there even a tape recording, and both counsel, after the fact, after this no was found, went back and listened to it, and that's why there was no motion to correct the transcript.
Your Honor, I think that we're straying off of the record that's properly before the court and reaching that conclusion. That would be my response. But yes, I would have to concede appears to be the case.
Sorry, I was just thinking out loud again. Let's assume, let's follow your argument that no one really is sure what happened. Is there anything that would suggest that failure, whatever it is, can't have a clear record, should inure to the benefit of the defendant in a criminal case?
Would you repeat the tail?
I'm not even suggesting there's a case on it, but I'm just... I was thinking out loud.
I guess
should
my
inure to the benefit of the defendant. Maybe that's a type of waiver on something of this sort.
I would direct the court's attention to, we don't have any published cases. We've got Singleton, where one juror indicated doubt, and then there was some communication between the court and the juror, and ultimately there was no objection made at the conclusion of that colloquy, and this court found, because there was no objection regarding the doubt of the juror, there's a waiver on appeal. You have a similar situation in the Gardner case. That's also a published case cited on brief. We have two decisions by this court. Bland, which was an unpublished decision, where one juror says here versus yes or no. There's no objection raised in the trial court, and it's waived under 5A18 on appeal. Then I apologize. I need to look back through. The other case that I was referring to is Turner, which is a 2002 unpublished case by Judge Felton. And in that case, the transcript shows only 11 of 12 jurors responded to the poll. 5A18, waiver on appeal. So
that's unpublished.
Those are unpublished, absolutely. It's not cited, and I apologize for that. I intended to cite that. So it's Turner, it's 2002, and it's an unpublished case authored by Judge Felton.
Was that more the Singleton issue as to whether there was a non-consenting juror, or is it this case where the record affirmatively demonstrates there was a non-consenting juror?
Our position would be that the record does not affirmatively demonstrate that, because the court... Well, that is our position, and I think that to allow this case to fall subject to the exception to the manifest injustice exception to the rule when there was no objection in the trial court, so the judge didn't get an opportunity to question the juror.
I don't think it would follow in that way. I think what you're looking at is the possibility of starting with what I suggested earlier. The record affirmatively says no. Your argument is, well, it could have been the other way. On that issue, if the court would take the position that we read it as an affirmative statement of no, the rest follows. And the question is, should we give the break to the defendant on what the record says, or should we give the break to the Commonwealth as to what the record says? Now, maybe that shouldn't be the question at all.
And I would submit
that,
Your Honor.
But if it goes that direction, it's clear the court can't enter that non-unanimous verdict.
I would submit, Your Honor, that it's not as if this defendant doesn't have a remedy. He certainly has a remedy. He has a remedy in habeas corpus.
Well, the Commonwealth has a pretty good remedy, too, because this is third offense, drug distribution, and it's a jury trial.
Well.
And the best that he's going to get out of it is a new jury to resentence him.
Yes, that's correct. But we submit that because the judge was not afforded the opportunity to question the juror And everything in the record indicates a unanimous verdict at sentencing. Everything else in the record indicates the unanimous verdict at sentencing. Nobody's, there are no bells and whistles going off. Nobody's jumping up. And certainly, this would have been a situation where that should have occurred if indeed the juror said, or he was heard to say no.
You would think.
We would ask that the court affirm the verdict. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Theron. Mr. Hamrick, as I mentioned, you have some time remaining. You do not have to take it all if you do not choose.
And I will be very brief, Your Honors. Your Honor, this was a case where the Commonwealth requested a jury. The record is properly before the court. The record is clear. The juror answered no, that was not his sentence. We would indicate to the court that there is no evidence of uncertainty in the question. No additional questions were asked, and we would be asking the court to take this up pursuant to the ends of justice 5A:18, and we respectfully ask the court to remand the case for a new sentencing hearing in the Pulaski Circuit Court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will greet counsel and then